Good afternoon. My name is Peter Albany. My attorney registration number is 13982. With me today is M. Colin Breezy. His attorney registration number is 25452. We represent the appellant Scott Cloverdance. We were also his trial counsel up in Love County when this case went to trial approximately in January 2 years ago. And may it please the court, I would like to reserve, if I could, 3 minutes. And we've raised two issues on appeal. These two issues involve statements, admissions that our client made. He made these shortly after he was put under extreme duress. He was faced a number of guns. The trial court found that could have been as many as 11 guns. 11 police officers came to his house. Those guns were eventually put down, but within 1 to 5 minutes, he was interrogated. Mr. Breezy and I claimed in the trial court, and we claim here today, that this broad array of guns certainly amounts to government coercion that was significant enough to overcome his free will. Secondly, we raised a violation of Miranda. What happened in this case is, under the same scenario, when the guns were put away within 1 to 5 minutes, our client was surrounded. He had one officer to his immediate left, he had another officer to his right, and an officer in front of him. At times he was told to turn around, so in back of him, so an immediate triangle of officers, and he was interrogated without any Miranda advisement.
Did this questioning begin in the garage or outside the garage?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and the record is not entirely clear, but we know that what happened outside of the garage is that he was ordered outside the garage, he was ordered to get down on his knees, and he was surrounded by three officers. That's the testimony of A.J. Horowitz. The actual recording that came into evidence took place in the garage. Officer Fain of the Larimer County Sheriff's Department, he said both at trial and in the motions hearing that this was a partial recording, that he started it at some point. He did not start it at the beginning of the interview, and that the record shows that our client was kept there for approximately 3 hours. At one point, the recording ends. Fain admits he could have spoke to him after that, but the main point, the recording that came in, the People's Exhibit 18 at trial, was the approximately 1 hour recording, just shy of an hour.
You say he was in the garage for 3 hours?
He was not in the garage, Your Honor, for 3 hours, but during the entire time of this interrogation, he was in a small space. His truck was partially backed out, so he was in a small space in front of his hood and in the small space of maybe 7 to 10 feet between the back wall of the garage.
How long was he in the garage?
At this point in time, that tape is just shy of an hour long, so I believe it's approximately 58 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, the other question is, during the time that he was in the garage, was the search still ongoing?
Yes, Your Honor. During the time he was in the garage, other officers of this 11 were in the house conducting a search looking for computers.
And how long did that search last?
That search started at 12:30 on October 5th, and according to the dispatch records, it ended 3 minutes shy of 3 hours. 4 hours and 57 minutes, Your Honor.
And is there a timing on how long the conversation took in terms of the hours and minutes begin this time, ended this time?
No, there is not, Your Honor. So we don't know exactly at what point in time over that 3 hour period it began and it ended.
Okay, thank you.
But is at the end of the record, first of all, the recording starts after there's a recording for a little while, one of the officers says, would you like to go inside? So that would suggest to me that it started outside. Is that inconsistent with your position?
We believe that it did start outside. Detective Fain said he could not be absolutely sure because he did not record the whole thing. The best evidence we have of what went on outside is Corporal A.J. Horowitz saying that when he turned the corner and came up, he saw the defendant surrounded by three officers outside, and each of these three officers had their weapons drawn upon him. And then he was told to come back inside, and Horowitz went and conducted other parts of the search and came back intermittently and joined the conversation about 10 minutes later when it started in the garage.
Mr. Albany, we all have listened to the tape, and do you agree that the tone of the interrogation could be characterized as conversational?
Absolutely, Your Honor, the tone is conversational. But given what happened here, while certainly that is one of the factors that can be relied on, given this overwhelming use of force by the police officers, Mr. Brzee and I would pray that that's not the factor that the court considers to be the strongest evidence, but it certainly was conversational.
All right, and at the beginning, at least of the recorded portion, the officer does state that you are free to leave, you are not under arrest.
Yes. At the beginning, Officer Fain says that he is free to leave, he's not under arrest. And when the second officer, A.J. Horowitz, comes in, he gives a similar statement that the defendant is free to leave, yes.
All right, so now my next question is, have you found any authority that discusses when there is a show of authority and force, but that ceases immediately before a conversational interrogation in which someone is told they are free to leave? Have you come across any cases and how that impacts both the custody issue for Miranda purposes and also the voluntariness issue?
The case, the closest case that Mr. Brzee and I encountered was the People versus Mumford case. It's a case out of Colorado Springs. And in that case, the police came to a house on a drug warrant. They spoke to Mr. Mumford and a couple of his compatriots, and there was a gun. And that gun was put away by the officer. In that instance, I believe it was one officer. And in that case, if I recall correctly, we've looked at a lot of cases. The court said that they did not find that that rose to a custodial interrogation.
All right. And how is this case distinguishable, or isn't it? Or talk about it a little bit more.
Every single case, when the appellate court reviews a case, you have to look at the unique factual circumstances of that case. The standard of review is that you look at the historical record as to what took place in the case, and if there's competent evidence to support that record, then the record stands. If the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court feels that corrections are made, you can make corrections. And then the appeals court gets to look at the law de novo. So in this case, all plethora of cases say one of the first considerations to look at custody is the physical restraint that the defendant is placed under. So in this case, as Judge Hoskins found on her December 17th ruling starting at page 36, she found that there was an overwhelming amount of force that was put upon Mr. Cloverdance on the day of this search warrant, the execution of the search warrant. And so this overwhelming amount of force precedes. She was not clear as to whether she said it was three or four officers. Her finding is that 11 officers went to that house and ascended upon the house of the defendant with their guns drawn. And so then, again, it's not clear, but the closest we get is Sergeant Fang saying that within 1 to 5 minutes from when he saw the defendant outside surrounded by the officers and the defendant was told to come back into the garage and the interrogation began, that was the brief time period that we had. Now, another significant consideration is whether or not a defendant is in handcuffs. Obviously, one of the clearest restraints is handcuffs. And in this case, Mr. Brzee and I filed a number of motions trying to say who was involved what happened here. None of the reports indicated that there was any handcuffs. None of the reports said that there was any weapons. Out of these 11 officers, only 4 officers filed any type of report. We asked if there was any type of internal investigation, any type of excessive force reports to help us out. We had to learn this on the fly. But at trial, what happened is A.J. Horowitz, almost on his own, said, I remember back, the defendant was in handcuffs when he was outside of the garage. And I remember that 5 to 10 minutes later, when I came back, he was no longer in handcuffs and the interrogation in the garage had started. In that record from the next morning, the last day of trial, Judge Kopkow had taken over the case, and respectfully, Judge Kopkow tried to diminish that. Oh, well, gee, this wasn't testified to at the motions hearing. Are you sure you're not making a mistake? And the next morning, A.J. Horowitz comes in and he's questioned again and he says, I remember that he was in handcuffs. So as a starting point, we think that's where the court in the district court should have looked and where this court has to look.
Excuse me, counsel. Are you contending, therefore, that the trial court was clearly erroneous when it said that considering the totality of the circumstances, again, after the house was cleared, after the defendant was out of the vehicle and standing, I can't find under the totality of circumstances that his freedom of action had been curtailed to a degree associated with formal arrest?
No. If we could, Your Honor, that's a great question.
And then the other thing she asked, she said, was the general mood of the question was conversational, and again at that point, Mr. Cloverdance was not restrained or given directions.
Okay.
So you're not challenging those findings as clearly wrong?
No. If we could, Your Honor, and this is a very important point, Judge Hoskins, the prosecutor, Ben Whitney, had argued the Pleshikov case, and Judge Hoskins found that she started her ruling that while the defendant was detained for purposes of the Fourth Amendment, he was not in custody for purposes of the Fifth. But that ruling flies in the face of what she earlier said, that this was, what happened here was associated with a formal arrest. So if we look at the type of meetings between a police officer and a citizen, you have a consensual meeting, you have a brief investigatory stop, and you have a full formal custodial arrest. So the judge says this is a full formal arrest, Mr. Brzee, and I agreed. But then she turns around and says, oh, it's only a detention, and clearly she is wrong. This conduct clearly amounts to a formal arrest. And as to
well, Judge, Mr. Albini, you're at 2 minutes and 20 seconds, just so you know.
Okay. Your Honor, if you wanted me to answer the second question, if you could repeat it under the heat of battle.
Go ahead.
Okay. If you would help me with what you wanted to know on the second part.
I think you essentially answered it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other considerations in this case that we want you to look at is that the defendant's wife was not allowed to come into the garage. And A.J. Horowitz, who directed the participants that day, told us he set up some armed officers on the perimeter. He had officers go in the house to conduct a search. He had officers make the initial contact. And he had officers ultimately do the interrogation. Now, it's not clear from any of these reports or from any of the testimony as to precisely who the initial officers were that contacted Mr. Cloverdance, ordered him out of the car, ordered him to get down on his knees at gunpoint. That is a formal arrest. And then Miranda should have applied. This little space of 1 to 5 minutes does not remove the taint of what Mr. Cloverdance had to go through. If you have any more questions, I'll do my best to answer.
All right, you've got a minute and 5 seconds that you may reserve for rebuttal then.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. This case is fact-specific. We're not arguing about the law. We're arguing about whether or not the defendant was in custody at the time he made statements to the police, whether his statements were voluntary. So I'd like to go through the facts specifically and perhaps elaborate on some of the facts that were the basis for some of this court's questions. What we had initially was no question, search warrant. The officers were allowed to go into the residence. They went in. There was any testimony from 8 to 11 officers. However, it was clear that not all those officers went into the garage initially when they encountered the defendant. Some were going into different areas of the house because the first 5 minutes they were clearing the residence.
Do we know how many officers were in the house?
No, we don't know exactly. I think there was references to having about 3 or 4 officers in the garage at one point, but people were also coming in and out. So I don't think we have any direct testimony exactly how many officers were in each room at each given point.
And were all 8 to 11 officers there for the entire 4 hours?
We don't know that. We don't know that.
You don't know if they left.
We don't know at what point any of them left. We do know what happened to the officers that were talking with Mr. Cloverdance during the interview, which was approximately a 50 to an hour minute interview in the garage. It sounds like there was about a 5 minute period before that interview after the officers arrived. So we know which officers were there during that period of time. I think they explained how there were some officers there that were more collecting the evidence, looking at the computers. Some were there purely for clearing the residence, kind of, safety issues. So they had different people there, different officers there for different purposes. So it's certainly possible that once the house was cleared and secured, some of them may have left. But all we know is for sure is that there was officers that entered the garage. We don't know exactly how much. However, there is an indication that it was not all 8 or 11. They did find him. This is not a situation where they entered the house and found him sitting at the kitchen table drinking coffee. They found him in his car, on his laptop, and they were looking for evidence of child pornography, which is on a laptop. And so basically what the officers did, the ones that entered the garage, they see this. They have their weapons unholstered, which they explain they do in every execution of a search warrant when for officer safety reasons. There's no exact indication of how many officers pointed weapons at the defendant. I think a reasonable inference is that it was certainly not all 11, but I think there was some indication that it was simply the officers, a few officers that were in the garage. He was ordered out and ordered to get down on his knees. There's no evidence whatsoever that the guns were put at his neck, which is something.
How about the handcuffs?
Well, there was no evidence at the suppression hearing whatsoever that handcuffs were used. Several people were asked. They didn't think they were used, but they weren't sure.
At trial,
it did come out. Officer Horowitz did indicate that there was handcuffs, and they did and reevaluate the suppression ruling at that point. But the issue was there was no handcuffs used. They were taken off as soon as the house was cleared.
So Ms. Hansen, just based on those facts, you had the trial court finding both initially at the suppression hearing and also when Judge Kopka reviewed it, that there was gunpoint, possibly handcuffs ordered to the knees prior to the interrogation. And I believe that Judge Hopkins had stated that it was overwhelming force. So I think the question that we're interested in here is, if 1 to 5 minutes passes between the overwhelming force and then a conversational tone told you're free to leave during the interrogation, is that force dissipated enough to render this not custody? Is it dissipated enough to render it a voluntary statement?
Absolutely, and I can go through, there's a number of factors in this case that demonstrate the de-escalation. First of all, we have way more factors of de-escalation than occurred in Mumford. In Mumford, there was guns. He was told he was not free to leave. Granted, it was a shorter period of time, but here what we have is the officers brought him out of the car, or directed him out of the car, brought him to the driveway so that they could clear the house, clear the, you know, he was near the computer. I believe it took 5 minutes. And then the evidence specifically says that they asked him to come back in the garage to talk to him. And so we're not, he wasn't even ordered to go back into the garage to talk to them. They asked him. So he agreed. And they, at that point, there's no question, there's no handcuffs, there's no guns. The guns have been holstered. And I don't think it's 1 to 5 minutes. I think it's pretty clear it's 5 minutes. 5 minutes had passed from when he was ordered out to when they asked him to go back to the garage. So we go back into the garage. At this point, the garage door is still wide open. There is a door into the house of which he had access while he was talking to two officers in an area, because the truck was parked halfway out. I think they said there was about 7 feet, and I'm not real good with distances, but I'm assuming that's kind of similar to the distance between the bench and myself. But there was about 7 feet. He had access to the door. There were times that Officer Horowitz came in to kind of check in on the interview, but he said he was kind of popping in and out, so he certainly wasn't blocking that door the entire time. So during that period of time, we have no handcuffs, no guns. He is specifically told, you are free to leave, repeatedly. He is specifically told he's not under arrest. And so if you just compare it to Mumford in and of itself, Mumford didn't even have that, and they found no custody.
And but the search was ongoing this entire time, was it not?
In-house, correct.
And that whole process lasted about 4 hours, correct?
You know, I guess I don't know for sure. I didn't, that wasn't something I think that was relevant, because the interview itself only lasted about one.
Why is it not relevant if the officers who are all armed are still in the house?
Well, they're all armed, but they're not engaging with the defendant. They're not even visible to him. He knows they're executing a search warrant on his house. The question is whether the defendant, who's standing in the garage talking voluntarily to two police officers who do not have their guns out, he is not handcuffed, they told him, you're free to leave, you're not under arrest, whether that person in that situation would feel that their freedom of restraint was curtailed to the degree associated with formal arrest. Like I said, there very likely were officers still in the house. Their guns were likely holstered. I think they talked about, you know, they have the guns out initially to clear the house, but there's no evidence that they came in and out of the garage with their guns out, no evidence that they came in and out of the garage with their guns pointed at him. There was just simply no evidence whatsoever that really anyone else engaged with the defendant as he spoke to the two officers, other than Officer Horowitz, who briefly came in and out.
So I understood Mr. Albani to say that while he was being interviewed, there were three officers. He was up against the truck, and there was one on each side and one in front of him, so that it wasn't practical for him to leave. That is not your understanding of the fence?
That is not my understanding. We have a, like I said, we have a 7 foot approximately area between the end of the truck and the house. There's a door that goes into the house. We have two officers on each side. They, I think, describe themselves about 3 to 4 feet away from the defendant. Officer Horowitz came out at times of that doorway and probably stood in that doorway. And during those periods of time, I wouldn't say it was blocked, but there was someone there. There was no indication whatsoever that he tried to get in the house. I think they invited him into the house. I think there was a point at which he sat down on the little step that was outside that door. But Officer Horowitz made it clear he was in and out, so he was not there at all times. So his egress, either into his house or out the garage, was never blocked.
Did the search warrant extend to his truck?
I believe so.
So he was not free to get in his truck and drive away?
No. No, and that's part of, you know, the Michigan versus Summers. They're allowed to detain anyone in the house. He could have walked away. He could have walked out, and I know the defense talks about how he was deprived of the opportunity to talk with his wife or his sister who showed up. There's no evidence of that. The only evidence we have is that the wife and the sister did show up at some point, and they were denied access to the house. There's some indication in the recording, which I didn't have a chance to review, but they asked, who is that outside? And he said, that's my wife. That's much different than someone saying, I'd like to talk to my wife. No, you can't. He was told he was free to leave. He was told he was not under arrest. If he saw his wife outside and wanted to deal with her and talk to her, he could have said, hey, I'm going to go talk to my wife. You've told me I'm free to go. So I think that's why the trial court probably said the issue with the wife and the sister is just not an issue.
So when the officers were telling him he is free to leave, what we do have is he's not free to go into the house because there's being a search warrant executed at the time, and he's not free to go into his truck. But he's at his home, so the only place he could go is to leave his own home.
Well, I don't know that he's not free to go into his home. I don't think he was told that you can't go into your home.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong. I thought that they were clearing the house to make sure no one was in the house so they could search it.
That was the first 5 minutes. They were clearing to make sure that there was no one else hiding that could possibly threaten their safety.
Okay, but, and the search was ongoing during the interrogation.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But there was no indication that he said, can I go inside? Can I use the restroom? Can I go get something to drink? Can I go sit on my couch? Anything like that. In fact, I believe there was some indication that they asked him and he said, no, we're good. And I think if you listen to the recording, it was clearly very conversational, very friendly. I think the defendant even at times was laughing. They were talking about various things. And so I think, if you take the fact that he's specifically told you are free to leave, you're not under arrest, you're not going to be arrested, and taken in the context of his demeanor, and they said he was not particularly distraught. He was nervous at first, but he was not emotionally distraught. Once the conversation began, it was like a normal conversation. I think a reasonable person in that position would not at all feel that they were their freedom of restraint was curtailed to the degree associated with formal arrest. There just simply is nothing here. No restraint used on him at that point. And everything was done to ensure him that, okay, this is done. This show of force is done. We're now going to do the warrant. We're now going to execute the warrant, and we'd like to talk to you. And they did. And he agreed, and it was a voluntary conversation. And so I think you have quite a bit of evidence that it de-escalated very quickly from the brief 5 minute period that it was necessary. And I'm happy to discuss the necessity of the force. I don't think that is at issue here, but I think the record overwhelmingly supports the need for the amount of force that was used in this case.
Well, let me ask you another question about Mumford, because I know you were saying that the facts actually in this case would justify that this was not custody and it would be a voluntary interrogation as well. Now in Mumford, Mr. Mumford was not the focus?
Correct.
Okay, and so I wanted you to address that a little bit, because in this case, clearly we have the defendant was the focus of the search warrant and he was being confronted with the evidence that the officers had against him. So I just wanted your take on how that plays into the analysis.
Well, he would have subjectively knew he was the focus because he knew he was the one who had downloaded the porn. I don't think there's any evidence saying we're here for a search warrant to see what you've done. I think in Mumford, it was an arrest warrant for that person. And so I don't think it's absolutely clear that Mr. Cloverdance would have known that he was the direct subject, other than subjectively, because he would have known. And of course, in a custody determination, you look at things objectively. But even if that's the case, even if a reasonable inference is that he's the adult male in the household, there's another adult female and two children that live in the household, even if we assume he knew that they were there for him, I mean, the case law is replete with indications that even if you tell someone they're a suspect, even you tell someone, we know you did it, we know you're guilty, that alone does not make it custodial. And so I think if you take that factor and then you take all the additional factors of de-escalation that we have here that they didn't even have in Mumford, I think Mumford was correct. This is even less custodial than in Mumford. Unless there's any questions, I would be happy to answer them other than that.
One question is the question of voluntariness and the Miranda warning or lack of it. Defense counsel has stated, and the court found, that he was under arrest, and I think you concede that he was handcuffed, he was placed on his knees. Why wasn't a Miranda warning given at that time?
Well, I don't, he was not under arrest. He was...
The court found he was.
No, the court found that he was in custody at the initial determination, the initial encounter for the first 5 minutes or so. That's a different inquiry than the question of formal arrest. So the thing, the issue is that the question is, if you have custody, see, I'm out of time, do you want to
finish your question?
Even if you have a custodial situation, that doesn't mean that events can't happen to render it then custodial. You look at the time of the questioning, and Mumford makes that clear. You look at the situation at the time of the questioning. And so I think that the court's finding was he was in custody at that initial part, but then he was not. I don't think they addressed the Fourth Amendment question of whether he was under arrest.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Albany, let's add 1 minute to your time because we did give the Attorney General an additional minute.
Thank you.
So that will leave you with 2 minutes and 3 seconds.
Okay. The court's questioned both parties about the comments made to our client that you are free to leave. And that's certainly one of the factors under the totality of circumstances that the court should consider. But at the same time, there's been a number of cases that said you have to balance a statement that you're free to leave versus the external circumstances. And the external circumstances suggest in this case that if a reasonable person tried to leave, they would not have been allowed to. They may very well have been shot. As Mr. Brzee and I, a reasonable person would have said, I may very well be in a position where my life ends if I do not cooperate with what's going on based on what's happened here. What's also of importance is there was a diagram, a brief diagram that I believe Mr. Brzee drafted while I was cross-examining Officer Mendez. And Officer Mendez admitted that when Horowitz was there, there was a triangle. One officer was at one bump, one headlight, the other officer was at another headlight, and Horowitz was on the step.
How long was Horowitz there?
It's not entirely clear. He came and went, but he came at about the 5 minute mark in the conversation, and it appears that he's there, I recall, the whole time, but I cannot say specifically, Your Honor. Okay? Another very key point is, on cross-examination from Mr. Brzee, Officer Fain admitted, Sergeant Fain, that he may have missed that the defendant in that intervening time when the recording was not turned on, may very well could have asked for an attorney. Could not recall. The whole idea of taking our client into that garage was to take him out of the public view. And that is a key consideration under Pleshikoff, under other cases, and
Mr. Albany, your time is up.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
That's all right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Your argument's been very helpful. So the case will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Now
Thank
we'll just
you.
Allow time for the...